Welcome back into the Just Above Average podcast. This is your host, Dominic. We're going to be switching things up a little bit this week. Previously, we had announced a topic for this third episode, but recent events have totally changed the world and the way things are going to go. So instead of the previously announced topics this week, we are going to be going with a little bit of RIP RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, talking about Trump's replacement on the Supreme Court, the electoral impact, a little bit about the Supreme Court. The second segment will be the NFL injury bug and recent coronavirus outbreak. What's going to happen there in the NFL, along with the major injuries to NFL stars. And then finally, we'll go through the debate recap of the first presidential debate hosted or moderated by Chris Wallace. So this is episode number 3 of the Just Above Average podcast. So let's jump right into our first topic here, RIP RBG, that being Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The late justice now was 87 years old and had pancreatic cancer. So offering respects to her, her family, all those who were fans of the notorious RBG, as she was once dubbed. She definitely had a major influence on this country, served on the bench honorably, and every American should take a moment to pay the respects to her as her record for advocating for gender equality, women's rights all across this country. So rest in peace, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That brings us to her replacement. Trump has decided to make a nomination to the Supreme Court, that being one Amy Coney Barrett, the 48-year-old justice of the Circuit Court of Appeals in the Seventh Circuit, which is the kind of Wisconsin, Illinois, Chicagoland area circuit court. She has been a professor at the Notre Dame School of Law. She had a pretty contentious nomination to the Circuit Court of Appeals, but nonetheless was confirmed by the Mitch McConnell-led Republican U.S. Senate. Now she is up for the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court of the United States. We are 35 roughly days away from the presidential election. And so being this close to the presidential election, it is inevitable that it will have an impact on that electoral impact. My initial thoughts, beyond kind of the hypocrisy that Senate Republicans have offered on their confirmation process for Barrett compared to that of Merrick Garland, is just striking. But that was 4 years ago, and this is now. I don't think that the Senate will be able to finish her nomination and confirmation process before the presidential election, the first week in November. That being that there are a lot of technical hurdles in the Senate nominating process that need to be cleared. Even the most bipartisan judges who get confirmed, like 99-1, take time. There's just a whole lot of procedure they have to go through in the committee process before it's ever brought to the floor. There's debate in committee, debate on the floor, interviews with the justice, with certain senators. So it's not one of these things that's going to happen in a 7-day window. I would be very surprised if they are able to kind of clear all the hurdles and get her confirmed before the election. But we'll see. I mean, Mitch McConnell is a wizard when it comes to Senate rules and Senate procedures. But I do think that there are some things at the Democrats' disposal to kind of delay that process until after the election. As far as the court is concerned, this will definitely shake up the way the court operates. Previously, it was kind of a 5-4 split decision with Chief Justice Roberts kind of always siding with conservatives, and Anthony Kennedy in the recent 5 or so years had been the swing vote one way or another in all the cases. Now, with Kennedy being replaced by Kavanaugh and assumingly Amy Coney Barrett being the replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think what we're going to see is Roberts become more of a swing vote. I think we've seen kind of in his opinions and the way that he writes on cases, he is a guy that focuses on keeping the status quo as much as possible, not rocking the boat too much. The other person to watch, I think, on the court is President Trump's first Supreme Court nominee, being Neil Gorsuch. Being from Colorado and in that circuit court, Gorsuch has already kind of carved out his own niche on the court, being very independent and not as staunchly conservative as, say, a Clarence Thomas or Antonin Scalia. There's been a few cases where he's kind of shown his independent thinking, especially as it relates to social matters. So I'm interested to see where Gorsuch comes down on that inevitable first big Roe versus Wade case that comes before the court, because you know it's going to happen. Being from Colorado, which is what I would call a liberal libertarian state, we've already seen him have kind of that libertarian view on social issues and some other cases. So I think it's going to be interesting. I think he might become the new swing vote and Roberts becomes the new Anthony Kennedy, where he has become more liberal / status quo upholding over time. Of course, I could be totally wrong, and then we see a 6-3 court and blows away all the precedent set in the past decade, but I don't think that's going to happen. Who knows how the election's going to go as far as the Supreme Court impact on the race. Traditionally, it favors conservatives because that's one of the issues they list higher on their priority list. But this time around, I think a lot of people recognize the very real chance that Amy Coney Barrett's selection will have on overturning the Affordable Care Act case or Roe versus Wade. These are big things, I think, to the suburbs that may juice liberal and Democratic turnout more than the conservatives, maybe for the first time in my lifetime when it comes to voting on the courts. But we'll see. The only other big thing here that I wanted to talk about is I'm going to assume Barrett is confirmed, whether it be before the election or in the lame duck session. But the next president, whether it be Trump or Biden, will probably get a chance to pick a couple more justices. I know it seems like a lot of turnover in the past couple of years, but Stephen Breyer is 82 years old. So not a spring chicken there. And Clarence Thomas has talked about retirement repeatedly, it seems like, for the past few years. A lot of people before Scalia died thought Thomas would be the next one to leave the court. So I think that we're going to see probably two justices in the next 4 years either retire or go off the bench in some form or fashion, would be my guess. I bet Breyer would retire earlier than he would have thought if Biden wins, and maybe Thomas kind of pushes it off if Biden wins, but who knows? So that's kind of my thoughts on the Supreme Court nomination. I think it's very hypocritical for Senate Republicans to proceed after what they argued in 2016, but it's my opinion that elections are for 4 years, a full 4 years. So the president was in his right to make a nomination, and I think the Senate should take it up. But I think it's totally irresponsible, and I think the American public should punish Senate Republicans for not taking up Merrick Garland's nomination 4 years ago. Just my thoughts. I think that Senate Democrats should take the high road and hold it over their heads and say, anytime that a opening has come open, we've held a responsible position and considered each nominee individually on their merits, and you have decided to make it a partisan process. I think they can take the high road and make that a issue for the future. But before we move on to the next segment, let's fit in an ad break. This is the Just Above Average podcast. Welcome back to the Just Above Average podcast. I am your host, Dominic. This next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the injury bug biting and the first potential coronavirus outbreak in the NFL. Since the last time that we have been together, the NFL has seen a rash of season-ending injuries to some pretty major stars. This is one of the arguments for the preseason games that some people are making nowadays, is that players have not been able to test themselves in game settings, and so we're seeing all sorts of major injuries, especially to stars like Saquon Barkley with the torn ACL, so done for the year. In that instance, it's a quandary, because normally the preseason games typically only matter for those at the bottom of the roster who are just trying to fight for that last spot on a 53-man roster. But this season it was cut entirely with working on coronavirus precautions and things like that. I'm a fan of a couple preseason games. Don't need to have four. That was a overbearing amount, but definitely after seeing so many major injuries to major stars, I think the NFL should probably go back to at least two games just so players can get their bodies ready and go through a run through. And we'll maybe see less injuries in the future. But some of the big major star list injuries, as I mentioned before, Saquon Barkley out for the year with a torn ACL. For the Broncos, starting quarterback Drew Lock out for a couple weeks with a shoulder injury. The team sounds like he's going to try and make it back for week five, but we'll see. Henry Ruggs, the star quick wide receiver for the Raiders, is out with a hamstring injury, as well as their other early round pick in Bryan Edwards at wide receiver for the Raiders. Their backup QB, Marcus Mariota, has a pectoral injury. He's been on the IR, but they do expect him back this season. Cam Akers, star running back, rookie for the Rams, out with some rib injuries. You go down the list and you just see IR, IR, questionable, questionable, questionable for stars all over the league. Rashad Perryman out with an ankle injury. We see Derek Watt, fullback for the Steelers, had a grade 2 hamstring strain. Deontay Johnson is in concussion protocol. Jimmy G, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, has that ankle injury. George Kittle's already missed a couple games with that knee injury. So you can go on and on and on about kind of the traditional injuries, if you will. There's a lot of questionable guys that aren't really questionable. They just take a day off on a Tuesday or Wednesday and the media freaks out. But what I want to get to kind of more on the injury side of the NFL is the fact that we had our first player this past week miss a game for testing positive for COVID, and that was the Falcons' first-round pick, A.J. Terrell. Luckily for the Falcons, or unluckily, I guess you could say, because they lost, he was the only one. He's been put into quarantine on the COVID list, COVID IR list. But breaking news we saw yesterday is that multiple players on the Tennessee Titans, and they had five other support staff members come down and test positive after their game with the Minnesota Vikings. This is a situation that I think the league has to get right. They're going to have to err on the side of caution because they don't want to see the entire season go up in smoke over one team testing positive. I think it kind of underscores the need for all the protocols that have been put in place, both for fans and staff and players. I think it's going to scare a lot of people straight in terms of following those protocols. So in some ways, I think it's a good thing. Obviously, we hope all of those players and staff have a full recovery, including all those in our country and the world who have had contracted COVID. We'll see what the league does. They have announced that they're going to postpone the Sunday matchup between the Titans and the Steelers. The Steelers don't have any positives, but they are the ones who are slated to take on the Titans in the Sunday matchup. The league said it's probably going to be either Monday or Tuesday, which a second Monday night football has been done before, so nothing special there. But a Tuesday game would be something special, something new that we haven't really seen in the past couple of years. So if you are a fan and you go to games, please make sure that you are following protocols because we all want to see NFL football. We all want to play fantasy football. Please, please, please follow protocols. Moving on to our main topic for the episode today, which was the shit show that was the first presidential debate. The first debate was held in the state of Ohio, and it was moderated by Chris Wallace of Fox News. And pretty much across the board, on both sides of the political spectrum, the reviews of the debate were poor because it was a shouting match, basically. And I don't think any of the voters at home learned much of anything. Entrenched a lot of people in the positions they already had. And I thought that America lost because that was maybe one of the worst debates, not performances, but worst debates as a whole in modern American history. How in 2020 they haven't figured out that they need to have a mute button on stage like the Around the Horn show on ESPN where they mute people who talk too much. Is beyond me because it seems like it should be a pretty simple bit of engineering to be able to mute one person who is continuing to interrupt not only his opponent when he's giving answers, but also talking over the moderator. Seems like at times Trump was in a debate with Chris Wallace, the moderator, just as much as he was with Joe Biden. And that's not saying, in my opinion, that Chris Wallace was siding with Biden because he was literally just trying to keep the time, the 2-minute time limit per topic, and then minute follow-ups. So it wasn't even like he was fact-checking or anything. It was just literally keeping the candidates to their allotted time. So as far as what the debate means for the election, I've mentioned it before, I think America loses, but I think the net result of the debate was a default Biden win, not because he won, but because Trump made himself look bad. And normally that wouldn't be as big a deal in the first debate, but in this election where so many people are voting early and voting with mail-in ballots, if they made up their mind last night and it was because they didn't like Donald Trump's behavior on stage, that's a bad thing for Trump because he can't win those people back who are already voting. He can't change their mind in the day before the election. They're going to be filling out their ballot today on Tuesday or Wednesday, they're going to fill it out with probably Joe Biden's name. If they weren't a fan of what Donald Trump did, they're going to sign it, notarize it, whatever, mail it back in. And that's a vote that's set in stone. So as we've seen, the polls favor Biden by 7 to 8 points. Every debate and moment that isn't going for Trump in a way that's attracting voters to him or solidifying the base to get those numbers up is kind of a default win for Biden, in my opinion. Trump needs to make gains, and last night he didn't do that. As for Biden's performance, I kind of approached or would like to make the analogy of if you're playing blackjack and you've already won quite a bit of money on the night and you decide you're going to put out a big chunk of change out there on the bet and you come up with a 17 and then you see the dealer draw out to get a 17 and you push, that's kind of what the night was, I think, for Biden, because he didn't perform overly well. He didn't perform badly. He didn't bust. If we're using blackjack terms, he didn't have a total meltdown. So nothing like that, but he didn't have a 20. He had a 17. He did fine. But when you have that low of a hand, I think he came out ahead by having a push. On the other hand, I could see how some people might say that Biden won because Trump and the Trump campaign lowered the expectations for Joe Biden so much over the past couple months, saying that he has cognitive problems and is, whatever you want to say, too old or whatever. I think you saw that in the post-debate analysis of people who maybe thought that or had heard that message so much. They thought that Biden was surprisingly strong or didn't fall apart, and so that made him look good. So when the bar is so low to where you don't totally melt down is the standard that you have to beat, that's probably going to be a good night for you if you're the Joe Biden campaign. I think when Joe Biden had those 2 minutes to give a full answer without being interrupted, I think were his strongest moments of the campaign. It's obviously prepared. And I'll backtrack just a little bit here because I don't want to suggest that Trump didn't prepare. Because in the first 10 minutes, when Trump brought his prepared answers with numbers and figures, you could tell he could prepare. I thought it was going to be a long night for the Democrats, because I thought maybe this one time he was taking an opponent seriously and had prepared and was going to smoke him, but he kind of defaulted back to his personality-driven stuff and let all the numbers and figures go by the wayside. Because in a traditional debate where those are the things that happen with citing of figures and stats and things like that, I think if it were traditional in that way, I think Trump would actually be probably a stronger debater, because Joe Biden's entire career has been more emotionally kind of feelings driven. It's not been the numbers nerd, superstar policy wonk Joe Biden. That's just not been his style. That's kind of where I think the one part of the campaign could come back to bite Joe Biden. But I don't think Trump has the either ability to stay on message that way, but we'll see. So after the first 15 minutes or so, when Trump fell apart and just started interrupting and debating Chris Wallace, I think it really looked, the light shone poorly on him every time he did that. But I don't think it necessarily is a election ender for him. Going back to Joe Biden's performance, I've come up with this analogy for Joe Biden in the fact that he is like a later career Bartolo Colon for all you baseball fans out there. Once upon a time, he had that mid-90s fastball that could blow right past his opponents and dominate debates. We saw that in 2012 with the Paul Ryan debate when the Obama campaign was kind of flailing. They needed a big performance from Joe Biden, and the man put up maybe one of the greatest VP performances that I've seen in the past 20 years. But it's obvious he's lost some stuff. He's no longer throwing in the mid-90s. He's probably throwing high 80s now. And it's inevitable that somebody's going to come up to bat and smoke some home runs. But Bartolo Colon in the later career is not meant to be a Cy Young Award winner. That's not what teams sign him to do. And I think that's kind of the analogy for this election. Progressives love Bernie, AOC, whatever. But I think last night in those answers, when Biden was distancing himself from the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, I think he did himself a favor. And the reaction that I saw today, at least from some of those progressive stalwarts, kind of confirms this to me. They kind of acknowledged, yeah, he's not obviously one of us, which the Trump campaign was trying to tie them together. And so when last night Joe Biden didn't take that bait, and then he kind of said, I'm the Democratic Party right now, I think that was a huge moment. But back to the Bartolo Colon comparison. Late stage Bartolo Colon is signed to chew up innings, so young relievers and young starters don't have to throw as many innings. He's not going to win the Cy Young. He's not there to throw a perfect game. He's not there to throw a no-hitter. He's there to chew up innings, have that low fours ERA, and move on to the next one. That's what Joe Biden is. Joe Biden is late-stage career Bartolo Colon. Doesn't have that mid-90s fastball anymore in debate performances. He's still fine. He's still got that upper 80s fastball with some off-change stuff. He's got a curveball here and there to where he can really hit it out of the park with his first home run. Maybe just like Colon hitting his first home run at age like 45, maybe Joe Biden hits his first home run and actually wins the presidency. So, yeah, that's what Joe Biden is this time around. He's late stage Bartolo Colon, chewing up innings, getting through this election on the Democratic side. He's not meant to be Max Scherzer or Justin Verlander with that nasty curveball changeup stuff. He's not there to pump it by you like Aroldis Chapman at 101. He's here to chew up innings, get Trump out of the White House, and then move on to the next one. And as far as that goes,
sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
That was Siri talking back to me. But yeah, as far as the debate went, I think that's kind of what Joe Biden did. He moved the ball down the field, didn't necessarily win, but he won by not losing. That's kind of what I thought. In terms of the election season as a whole, we just finished probably the second leg of a relay. You know, there's four people in a relay, four people run a lap. First lap being the primary season. Joe Biden finished that strong with a lead. We just finished the second kind of leg, which is the in-between convention season, first debate. Third leg will be the VP debate and next two presidential debates. And then the fourth leg will be that final push to the election. So at the moment, I think the Biden campaign is in a good spot. They're up 7-8, haven't done anything to blow a lead. They still, of course, got to finish strong, but in terms of debates changing the game, which they can in the past, they have before, changing momentum of campaigns and things like that. I think this did not do anything. And so by default, because this election has so many mail-in ballots where people are already voting and Joe Biden already has this large lead outside of the margin error in some places, like Hillary Clinton had like a 2 or 3 point lead, which is still within the margin of error. And that was with kind of at the same time in 2016 in that election. So this time around, I think it's an even bigger lead, and it's an even bigger deal at this stage because of those mail-in ballots. Obviously, it was a shit show. It sucked. America learned nothing. I think everybody was kind of on board with that analysis. Hopefully next time the Presidential Commission on Debates sets some rules with a mute mic so interruptions don't derail the whole thing. But that's kind of it for this episode of the Just Above Average podcast. In the, I shouldn't make a topic for the next debate because life happens quickly now. We all know that. But in the future, what I'll call tentative subjects for next week will be that VP debate between Kamala Harris and Mike Pence, and maybe perhaps a look at the U.S. Senate races and see where they sit as we go into October. We'll look forward to any October surprises that always hit campaigns. But as for this episode, this is the end of episode number 3 of the Just Above Average podcast.